WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. Film critic Vincent Canby called Ross McElwee a filmmaker anthropologist with a rare appreciation for the eccentric details of our edgy civilization. In his 1986 documentary Sherman's March, McElwee went south after being jilted by a girlfriend to see if romantic love was still possible for him. His cinema verite style, his deadpan delivery, and his gift for getting others to talk about him and themselves made this film a hilarious and unblinkingly frank meditation on his own anxieties and emotional paralysis. His newest documentary picks up where Sherman's March left off. Time Indefinite begins with McElwee's announcement to his family at their yearly reunion that he's getting married. His family's concerns about his marital status had been a central theme in Sherman's March. Using his signature documentary style and his ironic personal commentaries, Time Indefinite explores the details, the pains, and the joys of family life. Ross McElwee's presence is felt in every frame of his films. I told him that to me, he comes off as a hapless, bumbling innocent.
I think if I came across as someone who was perhaps too much in control, the film would not be as interesting. I think what the film is about, and what my other films have been about, is this inability to control life and the fact that life is always bringing surprises on us and that things never work out the way we think they do. And to convey that that I have some way of controlling my destiny moment by moment by being completely in control of things, I think would not be as interesting. So that's something I consciously strive for. And of course, it is true to me and to what happened in my life. I couldn't control the things that happened in the film. And those are reflected in how the film turned out.
In the beginning of the film, you announce that you and Marilyn are going to be married. And just after your announcement, and the camera pans from Marilyn mm-hmm. to your father, mm-hmm. and just after the announcement, the battery goes dead.
Yes.
And the comment you have, and this is about your father, mm-hmm. you said he gives off this Freudian force field that plays havoc with my
yes.
equipment. Is this a comment on a kind of a lifelong relationship you had with him?
Well, I'd say so. It's my relationship with my father was always one of restrained respect for each other. I think he was certainly somewhat baffled by how I could expect to make a living at what I was doing. He never had any kind of judgment about filmmaking as a way of making a living. As long as one could do it, he felt if you can do it, fine. You didn't choose to do medicine is a career, but be sure to find something that you can support yourself with. And that was always his primary concern. And when my filmmaking turned out to be the kind of filmmaking that would use him in it, I think that it made things much more complicated. His bafflement attained a whole nother level. He didn't understand why I was filming him. And ironically, it was surprising how many times my equipment did malfunction when I was filming him. It was almost as if he enabled things to short-circuit just by aiming a camera at him, just by looking at me a certain way. And I think that that's a kind of metaphor for how fathers and sons often end up regarding each other.
Well, did you find that filming him got you closer to him or got you talking with him about what you were trying to do? Did it create a conversation you didn't have before?
Well, it gave us something to talk about, that's
yeah.
for certain. I think when he saw Sherman's March with an audience for the first time, he did finally understand what it was I was up to. And I'd shown him the film as a kind of family event. And it wasn't the same thing. It took seeing it in the context of an audience of strangers for him to realize that, in fact, I wasn't totally I wasn't totally insane, that in fact this kind of filmmaking would have something of an appeal to at least a limited audience out there. And I think he could appreciate that. And the other thing he said to me, which I'll never forget, was after this initial screening that he sat in, and there was a great deal of laughter throughout the film at the moments when people are supposed to laugh. And afterwards he said, "I never knew you were so funny, son."
Mm. Did he laugh?
Oh, yes, he laughed. My stepmother said he was laughing so hard he was weeping at one point. And I've never seen him laugh that hard, so I wished I'd actually seen that.
Well, Time Indefinite, as much as it has humorous, hilarious moments, is, it seems to me, a contemplation about death. And death really weaves its way into the story. Your wife, Marilyn, has a miscarriage. Mm-hmm. Your grandmother dies during the film. Your mm-hmm. father dies. Mm-hmm. And you talk about the fact that when you had a brother who was 11, he died, and that your mother died about, I guess, 10 years mm-hmm. after that. Mm-hmm. It makes me wonder whether when you're starting a film like this and then things like that happen, what happens to the intention of the filmmaker?
Well, that's part of the attraction of this kind of filmmaking. And also what's scary about it is that the films do reflect life. And in a way, it gains its strength, I think, from what can't be foreseen. And I'm not the only person making films like this. I think there's a whole history of cinema verite filmmaking that relied upon this element of the unpredictable. It surely makes it a lot harder to make the films and then to know how to complete them. I certainly didn't foresee the deaths that occurred and never dreamt that a major theme in my film would be dealing with death. I thought it would be a pretty lighthearted treatment of what it's like for this particular person to get married in our society in this day and time and what it means to start a family if, you know, that happens. And that somehow a film would come out of that, but I never foresaw the turn that it took into, very real despair.
Well, at one point you say you were trying to, quote, corner death with a camera.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel that you could use the camera that way?
Well, it was an attempt to do it, perhaps knowing all along that it's an impossible thing to do. It's a psychiatric conundrum. You can't believe in your own death, or you stop living, and it's almost impossible to picture your own death. And I think in some crude way, I was trying, by dealing directly with the deaths of people who were close to me, to somehow fix the notion of death, come to terms with it with the movie camera. And of course the attempt was doomed to failure, and perhaps rightly so. Maybe the best thing to do is to never accept people's deaths and simply to move on in life. And I think that that's what happens at the conclusion of the film. But yes, I mean, I think I did try to push that as far as I could, gathering photographic proof in a sense of fixing down death and trying to nail it somehow.
Well, I want to talk some more, but we have to take a very short break. And my guest today is Ross McElwee. He's a documentary filmmaker, and his 1986 film, Sherman's March, was basically, McElwee turned the camera on himself. It was a meditation on love and women. And his new film is called Time Indefinite, and it's what happened after Sherman's March. It's about his family, his marriage, the birth of his son. We'll talk more after a short break. This is Fresh Air. I'm speaking with documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee. You got money, a grant, to do Sherman's March, and originally you were going to follow the route that Sherman took during the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
But after a girlfriend left you, you went south and filmed conversations with former girlfriends and some of the women that you met along the way.
That's right.
Did you imagine that you were actually making a film for anyone but yourself?
Well, no. I very much knew I was making a film for myself. And that was one of the decisions I had made much earlier, was to go ahead and make films that somehow reflected the particular vision that I had of the world, whatever that was, which is, I think, what, well, I won't speak, you know, for other filmmakers. It's certainly what I felt I had to do for myself in order to make something that I could be pleased with. And at the same time, I knew I had to make a film that would somehow have a place in the world, that to make a film purely about your own life and your own problems would not work, would not be of interest to anyone, unless it had some way of engaging an audience through any number of ways. And the ways I chose to make that work were by uses of humor, a humorous narration, and also by this odd parallel track, historical tract of General Sherman's march through the South. And somehow the mix seemed to work for most people anyway. And I could both thereby make a film for myself and also for an audience out there. And that turned out pretty well.
Well, part of the film is you looking for a woman and members of your family and other people trying to fix you up with someone.
Yes.
Did you get a lot of marriage proposals after that film came out?
Well, I got some inquiries. I wouldn't say I got formal marriage proposals. They don't come in writing anymore.
No.
I certainly got a lot of letters. But, you know, ironically, most of the letters that I got were not about my availability, but were about how do I make a film like this about my own life? People mm-hmm. wanted to know. I want to make a film like this. And I thought that was a very interesting phenomenon, that it had struck a chord somewhere in a large number of people out there who were really curious about this way of making films and saw their own lives as being equally interesting, which, of course, I think is true. Anybody's life, when looked at it a certain perspective, is infinitely fascinating if it can be rendered in some form that makes it accessible to other people through, you know, literature or through film or art. I mean, there's something about the everydayness, the mundanity of our lives that, you know, when viewed somewhat obliquely and given a twist or a turn, becomes something of universal interest.
Were you ever embarrassed about putting anxieties, your own anxieties, insecurities on film? Did you ever want to take anything back?
Well, the truth of the matter is that when I first made Sherman's March, I did not insert the segments that I had filmed of myself confessing my anxieties to the camera, because I felt I've gone over the deep end and this is something you don't do in films. And I made a mistake when I shot that stuff. I didn't even process it for close to a year after I shot the film, but I kept cutting the film and cutting it and realized it just wasn't working. Voiceover narration wasn't enough. I actually need to step in front of the camera and appear in it just as other people have. And so I finally processed those scenes, those little monologues, and reluctantly showed them to close friends, and they said, yes, this is what the film's been missing. This is what pulls it together. And after that, I got over my camera shyness. I went ahead and put in all the scenes that I'd shot, and they worked.
Well, I think there's something about a camera, maybe it's the person behind the camera, that makes people want to confess. And I don't know whether it's like meeting someone at an airport you've never met before, and after 20 minutes you've told them everything about your life.
Yes.
But there's something about a camera. Maybe it's just the sort of anonymous mechanical aspects of it.
I think there's some truth to that. I think there is this odd way in which psychiatrists and cameras have become the confessional icons of our age, whereas, you know, before it was the church, the priest. I think, you know, people have said that about psychiatry. Well, I think it's also true about cameras. And there is this way in which confessing things to the camera, confiding things, I would say would be a better verb, is definitely something that comes remarkably easy to a number of people, including myself.
Are you patient?
Oh, you have to be. Patience is one of the absolute necessities for this kind of filmmaking, which is also why it's not for everybody. I think we're in a... film and television has, in fact, stressed the opposite qualities, a kind of impatience with the visual image, as witnessed, as has been said many times, with MTV, but also with everything, television commercials, and even the way major motion pictures are cut. There's a kind of impatience, an inability to linger and absorb, which, you know, produces some interesting work. I'm willing to let a shot run for 2 minutes without edits, and to give people a chance to absorb the cadences of what someone's saying and their body language, and not simply the verbal content or the way in which someone slices open a watermelon and hands out the pieces of the fruit to a child, rather than simply, you know, a quick 5-second shot. I mean, this kind of patience, I think, is something I'm very interested in.
I've read a number of quotes about how you film, and I wonder whether you have a different relationship with your camera now. In Sherman's March, you said, "I'm filming my life in order to have a life to film." Mm-hmm. And in your latest documentary, Time Indefinite, you say, "It's hard to film my life and live my life at the same time." Are you in some conflict about that?
Oh, of course. It's a primal conflict for anybody who would undertake to film one's own life. And it's pretty much unresolvable. And in fact, that unresolvable quality becomes a theme in the film. But its broader implications, I think, are more universal. you think about the fact that most of us have to work for a living, and how do we separate our work from the time that's important to spend with people we care about, friends, lovers, wives, children, husbands? That's a very essential question that we're all dealing with, unless, you know, you happen to be lucky enough to have a trust fund and you don't have to go to work every day. But of course, beyond that, for those people who are misdriven enough to think they have to make their livelihoods as artists, it becomes problematical trying to decide over and over again, do I render this as life, or do I render it and simply live it, or does it have to become part of my art?
Well, that reminds me of a scene in Time Indefinite where you and Marilyn have moved to a different, a bigger apartment, and she says, if you put that camera down, you could help.
Yes.
And the idea being, we got lots of boxes here to unpack, and I thought it was an interesting admonishment to you.
Absolutely, and it's meant to be perceived as that. That's always the dilemma, and with writing, if you were writing a novel based upon your own life, you would at least have that ability to store something in your mind and come back to it later on in front of the word processor and put it into your novel. If you're writing a fiction film, you can make notes and later write it into a script, and it can be true to that experience. But with this form of documentary filmmaking, it's either get it as it's happening or forget it. It's gone. And therein also is, you know, a metaphor about life, and that life is fleeting and you have to take advantage of it as it happens. So what happens when the two come head to head? That's part of the conflict of this kind of filmmaking. And it's, I think, what gives an interesting tension to the films as you watch them.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us today. It's been a real pleasure.
Well, it's certainly been a pleasure being on your show.
Documentary filmmaker Ross McElwee's film is called Time Indefinite. This is Fresh Air.